and unsurpassed penetrating and perfect Dharma is rarely met with even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. Good evening, everyone, and thank you for coming. Well, thank you for being here. sorry. First up, I think I want to apologize for not having a discussion in the afternoon session that I had suggested, in the morning session. And my sense was that after having a practice discussion with a number of people, kind of based on those conversations, I thought, it's not really going to work to have a discussion. So I wasn't fully decided. I was still open to see how things would go. But when I returned to the Zendo, the silence was so profound. I thought, no, I can't do it. I just did not want to break that stillness and silence. So I hope none of you are or were too disappointed. There is one thing that I want to tidy up from the discussion earlier today, and that is I was talking about crunch time and the roll down, and I forgot to mention a wonderful, really wonderful shortcut. Okay? Shortcut to what? I'm not too sure, but it's a shortcut. And it's, if in the midst of pressure or a crunch, so the image that I have is the narrative, the story that we're telling ourselves is right up here in our face, screaming at us. Okay, so that's the feeling of it, that that's all we can see. It's all we can give our attention to. It's right in our face. If at that time you can look, stand still for a moment or sit still for a moment and look around and observe the background as if observing painting in a gallery. Just observe it. Observe the arrangement of things, of chairs, of doors, or kettles, or TVs, furniture. Just observe. Like now it would be the screens, the arrangement of people, the altar and the candle. And say to yourself, this or that is not caught up in my story. So as we give some of our attention to the background, what is in the foreground begins to recede. What's in the foreground begins to recede, and then there's a little bit of space for creativity and for breathing and for new ideas to come in, new perspectives to come in. If you continue with it, gradually the foreground recedes to the middle ground and the background comes forward to the middle ground. So everything evens out. and it's no longer the pressured situation that it was. So this could be seen as a shortcut to equanimity, or a shortcut to being present. Tidy up, turn your memory on. I'm going to give a short book list. There is The Mind of Clover by Robert Aitken. There is Being Upright by Reb Anderson. Taking Our Places by Norman Fisher. There's another book by John Dido Laurie, whose title I can't remember. And there's one that I haven't read yet, but I got it from Amazon. And I'm pretty sure it's called Circle of the Way. It was recommended by one of my students. And he said it's really good. It's an easy read, and it's really good. It's kind of a short history of Zen. And then there is Zen's Chinese Ancestors by, I think it's Andy Ferguson, but it could be Bruce. Okay. And then if the person who asked the question, I don't know how highbrow they want to go. And in the last two practice periods, we were reading Shinshu Roberts' Being Time, which is an explanation or a commentary on Dogen's Uji, and Uji translates as Being Time. Now that won't only raise your eyebrows, it will burn them. So, if that's the kind of thrill you're looking for, that's what I recommend. Yeah. So, somebody asked me to comment on something specific. So it's, we'll say, a significant person in somebody's life took their own life. And could I comment? I think they wanted to know, what is the Zen approach to suicide? So we never really know what is in the mind of another or what they are going through, unless we are very much in their confidence or in their trust. And I'm thinking especially with something like suicide, somebody who really intends to do it is probably not going to talk about it, because they can anticipate the sense of, or they can sense the impending attempt at dissuasion. Right. So death leaves the living in a state of grief and loss. And my feeling is that in the case of a suicide, there is that extra dimension of extra bewilderment. And so the survivors or the relatives, the friends, the loved ones of the person are left more to deal with than if the person had just been killed in a road accident or died of natural causes. So my take on it is that Zen would never condemn the person who committed suicide. Zen practitioners would not. There is no Zen that would do it or Zen that wouldn't do it. Zen practitioners would not condemn the person who committed suicide. And I've sometimes thought about it myself. It's not that I've contemplated committing suicide, but I hear on the news or something that somebody has committed suicide, and then I think, well, gosh, how would I go about it? Or would there be any circumstances in which I would do it? And I can't say there's definitely under no circumstances would I ever do such a thing. We never know. We never know where our minds will go. We never know what situation we'll be in. As a teacher, my job is to be here for you. And I like to think I would hang in to the very end. But then there's another aspect to it. A few years ago, I think I don't know if it was a doctor of physics or a doctor of medicine or somebody flew over from Australia or New Zealand to go to Holland, where euthanasia is legal. And he had a terminal illness, and he didn't want to go through the various, we could call them, sufferings of final stages of whatever he had. And I could see myself doing something like that. If I was diagnosed with a terminal illness, then a quiet, ordered, dignified exit might be preferable to the alternative. But there's part of me thinking, you know, it'd be just my luck that there's an announcement that they've got a cure for it just after I've taken the fatal injection or something like that. And that would be kind of poetic. Now what do I do? Another fine mess. As I say, when somebody dies, all we can do is digest the grief and the pain that comes up, the emotions that come up in response to that great loss. As part of this scene where I go over to Holland, I bring a group of Zen practitioners with me, and we chant the Dai Shindarani while I'm on my way out. I think that's great. That's not my favorite way to go. My favorite way to go, it's not as though we really get much of a choice in this, but if. My favorite way to go would be in Zazen. Right? Everybody gets up for Kinhin, except me. Right? And gradually they realize, oh, better check and see if he's dead. Right? Sorry. Anyway, excuse me. So we don't know. How is it going to end? I actually, really, I want to live a very long time. I want to live to be 1,000. I think that seems about right. Seems that might be satisfying. And of course, when I think of living to be 1,000, it's in my present state of health. Right. And that would be just great. Okay. But it's unlikely to happen. They might find the magic switch for the DNA or something that makes us immortal before I make my exit. Suzuki Roshi says in Zen Mind beginner's mind, 100 years of life is good. 1 year of life is good. And it's that life is good. And as I was saying, we live to support life and to practice the way of Buddha. So if our intention is to practice the way of Buddha, it doesn't really matter whether we live 1 more year or 100 more years. But the other side of me has nothing to do with practicing the way of Buddha. Just wants to have coffee and watch Netflix and stuff like that. I want to live to be 1,000, right? And it would be a mixture of the two. So. So this brings to mind a wonderful poem. And the poem, can't remember the name of it at the moment, it's by Yeats, and it goes, "We who are old, old and gay, oh so old, thousands of years, thousands of years if all were told. Give to these children, new from the world, silence and love and the long dew-dropping hours of the night and the stars above. Give to these children, new from the world, rest far from men. Is there anything better? Anything better? Tell us it then. Us who are old, old and gay, oh so old, thousands of years, if all were told." My gratitude to this wonderful building, Gaia House, to the walls and the rooms, the floors and the ceilings, to the grounds, beautifully kept, my gratitude to Gaia House. In, I think it's the Fukanza Zengi, which may or may not be in your chant book, it says, "Grass, trees, walls, tiles, and pebbles all engage in Buddha activity. And those who enjoy the benefits of wind and water caused by them will unroll widely inside and outside of the entire universe, the endless, unremitting, unnameable, unthinkable Buddha Dharma." Now, is that not encouraging? Don't you want to unroll widely inside and outside of the entire universe, the endless, unremitting, unnameable, unthinkable Buddha Dharma? Yes. Okay. Good. So my gratitude to the building, to the walls, to the gardens, to the countryside, to the birds and bees. My gratitude to the community of Gaia House that makes this possible. My gratitude to all of you who sat through this retreat. My gratitude to the Doan Rio and to my Jisha, to Rebecca and to Anshin. My gratitude to the bells. Yeah. My gratitude to all the causes and conditions that made this retreat possible. Back in 2004, 2005, 2006, or 2007, I led a retreat in Grinnell, Iowa, and the snow was knee-high, not in the house, the snow was knee-high, and the temperature was, I think, minus 20 centigrade. I think. I could be wrong, maybe it was minus 20 Fahrenheit. It was a good deal below freezing. And on one day I went out for a walk and I noticed that when I smiled, my cheeks tended to stay in the same position and slowly melt back into the relaxed position. And of course, a zip-yup hoodie thing, just eyes looking out. But the magic of that is that my birthday occurred during that retreat. And I shared at the end of it that my birthday was in the middle of the retreat or something, and that the retreat was the best birthday present I could have had. Now, since then, there's been many retreats, and some of them, to use a relative word, some of them were better than that, but they've not been on my birthday. So as a birthday present, I thought this was the best thing I could have had. So my gratitude for this practice and my gratitude for being able to share it. And of course I couldn't share it if I didn't have somebody to share it with. So that brings us back to my gratitude to you. Right. I want to share two incidents that happened, and I'm not too sure. Well, the second one I am sure, but the first one I'm not so sure. There's something, some reason in it. Some rhyme, maybe not reason, but some rhyme in it. It occurred to me 30 years ago, not to the day, but almost to the month, I had a motorbike accident. And my bike was a write-off. I was coming along a dual carriageway and the road was clear in front except that in the left-hand lane there was a car with its left indicator on and a turning in front of it into a housing estate. So I went to pass on the right and it swung right. I hit the bonnet and was catapulted over it and rolled along on the other side of the road. Luckily, no oncoming traffic. So that was, I'm pretty sure, the 16th of March, 93. I got out with bruises on my chest, headache from hell, and a very badly sprained ankle. And the doctor in the hospital who checked me over said, in his experience, it's either very bad or minor for motorbike accidents. There's very few in between. So I was very fortunate. But the thing that I wanted to share is a few days later, I went back to look at the bike which had been taken to the police station, and it was a write-off. And I thought, that could have been me. Now, at this time, I'd been meditating for 2 years, and the way I describe it is that my meditation practice had begun to bite. I could feel the biting point, right? And I'd become curious, where is this leading? So when I saw the bike, I thought, you know, I was so lucky. I could have broken something or damaged my spine or neck and not been able to meditate for months. Or I could have been killed and that would have been it. So I decided to stop riding bikes simply because I wanted to know, where is this meditation practice going? You could say, I had something to live for. And it's not like I was driving recklessly. I did want to live, right? I was driving very defensively and cautiously, headlight on, reflective jacket, white helmet. What did you not see? Okay. But the point is that because my meditation practice had begun to bite, I really wanted to safeguard it and see, where is this leading? So this is kind of provoked by the question, what is the meaning of life? So for me, riding a motorbike, there was no real meaning, but there was a joy. And you could say that the joy was the meaning, or the purpose was whatever I came up with. But life presents you with its own koans, and if you explore it enough, you'll find a meaningful path. So the other thing then that I want to share is around about the same time. So I picked up this book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, in February 1991. And my mother had died 7 months before. And for some reason, I was the only one interested in getting or making or getting a headstone for her grave. I guess that goes with all my siblings had also become atheists. And for them, I don't know why, but it didn't really seem to be that significant. So at that time, I was very moved by this verse in this book. So sorry, Patty, I'm not going to get to your waterfall. At least I don't think so. There's a beautiful 2 pages in this book with no words on it. Great. There is a drawing on one of them. So this chapter is called God-Giving. And the opening verse is what I was turning over in my mind. Somehow, okay, so I wanted to put, in loving memory of, and then there's usually something else that goes on it, and I saw all the other ones, and I didn't really gel with them. So this is a few years, like 2 years after my mother had died. But this was, I wanted to make something out of this. Suzuki Roshi says, to give is non-attachment. Now that's a quote from somewhere else he's quoting. To give is non-attachment. Then he elaborates, that is, just not to attach to anything is to give. In reflecting on this and turning this over, I wanted it to be something like that. But also in reflecting on it and turning this over, there's this, like, the meaning is that if we can somehow not attach to anything, then our being or our presence is a gift. It's a gift to those around us, and it's also, I later began to think, this is when I was doing Zen, it's also a gift to the trees and the walls and the tiles and the pebbles. It's just a gift because it is empty. So what I came up with was, in giving, there is peace. And I remember bringing this into the, what would you call it? The tomb. Who does the inscriptions on? The who? Oh, okay. That's simple. I thought it was going to be the tomb master or something. So I remember giving this into the place that makes all these headstones, and I told him the inscription that I wanted, and he wrote it down. And then he looked at me with a tear in his eye. Oh, wow. Must be something good. Okay. So that's what it says. In giving, it's written in stone, in giving, there is peace. And this thinking later evolved into relationships in general, that quite often when we enter into a relationship, we can be thinking of what we want from the relationship. Whereas this understanding or this idea is, I'm not here for what I can get. I'm here for what I can give. So it really changes things. And it's a general attitude towards life that my purpose is not to get things, but to give. And I actually remember one of my science teachers in secondary school saying, it's the nature of everything, it's the nature of everything. Everything in nature wants to give off its energy. So, oh wow, okay. So to give. But I really love that. To give is non-attachment. That is, just not to attach to anything is to give. Now it's very difficult to simply, okay, I'm not going to attach to anything. And then you find what you are attached to. But we can practice going into situations without an agenda, and if we're meditating, this is a little bit easier, just going into a situation and responding rather than going in with the agenda of what we want. Now, if we have a job, that's not always possible, so it's not something that we can do all the time. But we can do it some of the time. And then there is this beautiful verse, and note to myself, and note to Rebecca, and note to Anshin. I want to change the wording than what we used on Sunday. This is not it, this is somebody's note. Let's see if I can get to this. I don't know how it's phrased in the ceremony that we did on Sunday, but I thought, it's a little bit clunky. The way it's in my head is within our past, present, and future karma, the bonds of attachment are hard to break. Realization beyond the realm of karma is the offering of true compassion. Now that's a really good incentive to have a realization beyond the realm of karma. Okay. But the question is it that true compassion is offering to us a realization beyond the realm of karma? Or is true compassion what we have to offer when we have this realization beyond the realm of karma? And for now, we can say both are true. So it is the offering to us of true compassion. And when we realize it, it is our offering of true compassion to all beings. To be have this realization of beyond the realm of karma. So I said earlier that my job is to be here for you. And hopefully I will be here for 1,000 years, but failing that, as long as I can. But it's also possible that I will suddenly, someday, decide, it's time to do something else. Adios. Okay. I don't really think that will happen, but I can't rule it out. Maybe I will take myself off to a Theravadin monastery and live out my days in blissful meditation. Or maybe I'll go the opposite. I'll say, I've been ignoring samsara for too long. I better dive back in and see what it's really like. Okay, we don't know. Well, it's also possible that I will do the Zen and the art of motorcycle thing. You know. I was living at San Francisco Zen Center, and one day there was like 4 huge motorbikes outside, and I was really admiring the bikes. Wow, great. And then I go in, and there's this team of bikers, and they've just done the Robert Pirsig trip across America, right, following his route from wherever it was that he started, and worked the way through the same route that he took to San Francisco Zen Center. Great. I wonder if they made a film or wrote a book on it. So, Paris mentioned that on some of my sessions we sit up all night. And there's one in particular, it's Rohatz, or Rohatzu, where you're invited, or you're invited to sit up all night. And you don't have to sit up all night. You can sit up for part of the night. You can, when you're sitting, you can leave the zendo whenever you want and make a cup of tea or coffee, or have something to eat, and then go back to sitting, or you can go and take a nap for an hour or two and then come back to sitting. But Norman and Blanche were, and Paul, to I think the same extent maybe, were real encouragers of sitting up all night. And it can be a profound experience. It's certainly a profoundly tiring experience. The next morning you're totally spaced out, but the effort is great and the beauty is wonderful. And I remember coming out, sitting up all night or through the night, coming out of the Zendo at Tassajara. And this usually takes place on Rohatsu, which is the Sesshin. It's kind of the ultimate Sesshin in Zen, in the Zen calendar. And it occurs in December. And I came out of the Zendo, and there's the wooden deck around it called the Angawa. And there's the moonlight. It was coinciding with a full moon. And Amy Hutto was sitting in the deck. And it was just, you reminded me of this when you said you walked into the Zendo and you saw me sitting. I was remembering that image of Amy Hutto sitting facing the wall and the moonlight just missing her. So you, this sharp line of the moonlight sitting still, and it's just a picture, a beautiful picture. It's freezing. No, I'm not going to do it. And it's only a few degrees warmer inside, but at least it was a few degrees warmer inside. Yeah. But sitting up all night can be exhausting, it can be beautiful, and I don't know. Some people say, it's kind of bad for your practice because it tires you out so much. But the beauty of it, it's worth it. So, sometimes I have a sesshin, and particularly on Rohatsu sesshin, I encourage staying up all night on the last night. But I'm not doing it here because this is a retreat and it's not Rohatsu. However, if you want to, I don't see why not. Okay, just stay up all night. So I want to move on to the topic that's going to be, you're going to be met with, or you're going to meet in the morning. Is the giving a dana talk, and if you've been here before, you know what that means. And maybe if you don't, if you've not been here before, you still know what it means because you know the meaning of the word. So it's about giving. And part of the giving is to, part of the giving is to me. And I thought, well, I'll just give you a little background. There's a few people in the room who contribute monthly to me via my website, and that amounts to about 500 euro a month. Then I do some odd jobs for friends around where I live, and that combination adds another 200 or 300 a month. So what I'm asking you is not so much for money, I'm asking you for support. And whatever you can donate will be greatly appreciated. But I don't want that to undermine my appreciation for your practice of participating in the retreat in the first place. At the same time, I'm supposed to make an appeal for dana. Anshin let me off the hook last year and made the appeal on my behalf. Last year, before I came here, I got an email from somebody who said, "We've just received a windfall and we'd like to give you 10 grand. I thought, wow, that'd make a huge difference. Are you sure you want to do that? And they said, yeah, we're sure. Okay, There were two of them. And so we tried to transfer it into my bank account and it failed, and we tried again and it failed. And they were getting onto their bank and I was getting onto my bank, and my bank said it was their bank's problem and their bank said it was my bank's problem. And in the end I said, look, how about you just pay through my website €1,000 a month for 10 months? And they said, okay, we'll give that a try. And that worked. So that made a huge difference to me last year. And it really meant that I could travel to Hebden Bridge without worrying whether the trip was going to pay for itself. I went to Hebden Bridge to ordain Rebecca. And it just takes the pressure off. So if you happen to have 10 grand or 100 grand, feel free, right? I was thinking, you know, there's this story in the Bible where an old woman puts a penny into the donation basket, and Jesus says, you know, this old woman, her donation is more than all of yours combined because she has given everything. I thought, well, I don't want you to give everything. Hold back enough to take care of yourself and your loved ones and just give me the rest. What I really want to get to, though, is it's the idea of support rather than the idea of payment. Okay? If you like the work that I'm doing, even if you feel as though it isn't for you, it's maybe you think it's the kind of work that you would like to support. And so it's coming more from, what can I give? How can I support this practice? And this is one way. And you may have other ideas as to how you may be able to support it. You may have skills that you can lend to me or something. Anyhow, whatever you can give, if it's not 10 grand, if it's 10 pound, it's deeply appreciated, very much so. And it will help my coffee fund very much. Claire, you may notice, is missing. And she was so apologetic. She'd been on a number of my retreats in Sesshin. And I was really shocked that she had to leave. But she wants you to know that it's not because of an emergency or something urgent. She made a mistake. And has two trains to get home and has booked those trains for today. She thought it was ending today. So she was somewhat embarrassed and greatly disappointed to have to leave before the actual ending. So what I think I would really like to do, instead of going off to a Theravadin monastery, is to set myself upon a golden bough and sing to lords and ladies of Byzantium and to the lords and ladies of Newton Abbot, Totnes and Ashburton, but sing to lords and ladies of Byzantium of what is past or passing or to come. Thank you all very much. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.